Thank you for listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On. I'm excited to interview Dr. Clark because Dr. Clark has been in the field of providing therapy for years. Why don't you introduce yourself to the audience?
Thank you. Yeah, so I'm Dr. Carol Clark. I'm a therapist first, and then I'm an educator, and I've both do therapy with and educate about all things gender, gender identity, gender diverse. This is the newest term, gender things, people who are gender diverse, issues related to gender diversity. I'm also a trainer for therapists, and I have a couple of training programs where we offer a training to therapists in gender diversity and addiction, hypnotherapy, kink therapy, sex offenders, and sexuality and disabilities is coming up. And then I have a PhD program in clinical sexology, which you are well familiar with. I'm so proud of you. And I'm the author of Addict America, The Lost Connection, which is all about our connections and loss of connection when we start living addictive lifestyle. And the accompanying workbook, which is My Pocket Therapist, 12 Tools for Living in Connection. And they're just great books for everyone at any point in their lives. Okay, so you don't have to identify as an addict to use these and have them improve your life. What do you want to talk about today?
Well, I just wanted to touch base on your program. It was an absolutely wonderful experience for me personally to work on my PhD and work towards that goal. But I also wanted to mention your book, Addict America, which you are right, anybody can read this because, as you have always said, we're all addicts, addicts of something.
We are. We get into addictive lifestyles. So even the phone, our phones, technology, computers, shopping, being on the internet for all kinds of reasons, gambling, drugs, alcohol, of course, pornography, any kind, a lot of sexual behaviors. It's all about addiction. It's not about sex. And when we're in an addictive place, that comes first and it interrupts our connections to each other and our connection to the universe, to a higher power. So when we're living lives that are just not going well because we don't have close relationships, we have problems with intimacy and connection and communication. You know, I see a lot of people come in, they say, oh, we're not able to communicate. And communication is really broad. What does that mean? Well, they can't communicate about the things that really matter. What prevents that? And it's that fear of intimacy that manifests from underlying trauma. So to back up, summarize, we have underlying trauma from our childhood that gives us messages that we're not good enough, we're not important, and then that leads to a fear of intimacy, fear of getting too close to another person. And then we try to control how close we get to people to protect ourselves. And this causes us a pain, an existential pain, because we're meant to be connected. We yearn for connection. So we're constantly in this push-pull of wanting to be connected, fearing connection, and feeling pain when we're disconnected. And then when we do addictive behaviors, any kind of behaviors, anything that gives the brain a lot of extra stimulation that we feel causes us pleasure. You know, it ties into the pleasure centers of the brain. So we get all this stimulation that we interpret as pleasure, and that relieves the pain, and we want more of it. And then now we're into that addictive cycle. If you go to my website, I have a few websites, but if you go to my website, drcarolclark.com, so drcarolclark.com. At the bottom of the first page, it says intimacy and connection and recovery. I think there's a beautiful graphic that you can see what I'm talking about here, the evolution of addiction and then what you can do about it. So you can open up that document. And then there's another article there. It's called Intimacy by the Numbers. And so those are gifts to anybody who wants them. And they're right there on that website. And that really talks about this whole addictive process and why I look at all of us as being an addiction, because we all have these messages from childhood, again, that interfere with being fully connected. And, you know, whether or not you identify as full-fledged addict or you just say, you know, I have problems with relationships, it's going to be helpful to really look at how can I push through that? How can I truly be connected, not fear connection? And be part of the universal life force, be aware of that connection.
So what about the trans population? What have you seen there as far as addiction.
Yeah. So what happens is for people, unfortunately, in our world today, especially for those of us in the U.S., but in a lot of other countries in the world, there is a lack of acceptance of any kind of gender diversity, of people who are outside the binary of identifying as male or female, or people who identify as male when their bodies look like female and vice versa, and manifests in some really negative ways, all the way to some really ugly ways, and where people don't feel accepted. People are given the message that if you're not exactly as we, the adults, we, the culture, are telling you you have to be, then there's something wrong with you. You're not going to be accepted. You're not going to be loved. Kids get these messages. And so there you go. That's the trauma that I'm talking about. That's the pain of disconnection that kids grow up with. So trans kids, so generically we'll say trans for transgender, trans kids grow up seeing the world through that filter, like not going to be accepted. I have to be something other than who I am. I can't be who I am if I'm going to be loved. And which is horrible. And then that causes that pain of disconnection. And so it's real easy to then find drugs, alcohol, porn, relationships that aren't so great. You go seeking after other people to feel validated. That's not true connection. That's just objectifying people and saying, love me, so that I believe that I'm lovable. So we have a lot of trans people that end up living in addiction because of that, because they see the world through that lens.
How did you end up providing such a wonderful service to the trans community?
Oh, that was thanks to Dr. Marilyn Volker. Back in 1991, I moved down from New Jersey with my fresh master's degree in hand. And this was so crazy about the world of sex in general, is especially in this country. The U.S. is so nutsy about sex. You mentioned sex and people just lose their minds. And so here I was trained to be a counselor, a therapist, and I didn't even have one class that talked about sex, human sexuality, and which is insane. You know, how do you practice therapy and not be able to talk to people about sex, about their sex lives, about their bodies, about issues related to sex? So when I moved to Florida, in order to get licensed as a therapist here in Florida, I did need to take a human sexuality class, one class. And so I went to a university where Dr. Volker was teaching, and I took the class with her, and she got me really fired up about human sexuality and being a sex therapist. And she also brought in a panel of trans people. And I was just mesmerized. I probably, like so many people, especially of that generation, you know, going back a few years before the internet, I knew about a couple of people in the news. Christine Jorgensen had been a big tennis player who transitioned from male to female. You know, that's about all I knew. I didn't realize that, you know, really I was surrounded by people who are gender diverse. And Dr. Volker's class opened my eyes to that. And so I said, I want to specialize with this population. And I started making friends with trans people and taking trans people to lunch and joining trans groups, attending trans groups that would let me in. Since I don't identify as trans myself. And I started learning as much as I could. And then I was invited to facilitate a support group. So there was a few trans people that had formed a support group, but they were kind of struggling with their leadership and they were having some difficulties. And they said, we need to bring in a therapist. And they knew about me because I'd been insinuating myself into every arena I could. And so they invited me to facilitate the group, and I did that for about 25 years. I started seeing trans people in my clinical population for therapy, to write letters, because trans people who want to transition with hormones or surgeries need letters from a therapist. And while a lot of people think that that's wrong or they shouldn't need that, I have a couple of workshops. I have a workshop I do on informed consent and the role of the mental health counselor in helping people transition, and I think it's very important. And that's not to say that you or anyone else don't know your own minds, but it's to say that we all need guidance going into a new area of existence that we haven't really experienced. And that my experience working with hundreds of trans people over the years makes me a good guide for that, can help you avoid a lot of pitfalls in transitioning. So I started seeing a lot of clients And people would call me from around the country and even from other countries, because once the internet, you know, really took off, then I was online and my name was getting out there. And I would talk to people. I was never not talk to anyone just because they were from somewhere else. And so I talked to people, but I realized we need to train more people. It needs to be not just me. So back in 2012, I got Dr. Volker, Jessica Lamb, who's a trans woman who does a lot of educating, and she's come to my classes once I started teaching at the university, and she'd sit on my panels because I was paying it forward what I learned from Dr. Volker. And we got a couple of other therapists, Dr. Maylene Batista. And back then in the beginning, we had Dr. Christina Sobroso. She's since moved on to other things, but we still have our core group. And we started doing trainings, and we train people around the world to work with trans people. And all the ins and outs, and the program has grown, and what we teach has grown, and we have up-to-date information, because even therapists who have worked with trans people for many years haven't kept up with all the changes. You know, you do something for a long time, you kind of get into your groove. Sometimes some of the old timers, they might be accepting, but they are not up on the latest of what's going on in the trans world. So even the term gender diverse, I'm getting used to that one, because the WPATH Standards of Care, that's the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, which is kind of our guiding professional association. They've gone through many incarnations as well. So we've gone from transsexual to gender nonconforming and non-binary to now gender diverse, as well as transgender, because that's still the widely recognized term for people who are actually transitioning. A lot of people aren't transitioning. They're not doing anything different. They just want to live as who they are and how they identify. So that's something else people need to know about. Anyway.
Let's take a momentary break, and we'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We're back from our break. Have you seen a shift in language as far as that informed consent is concerned?
Yeah, a little bit with language, a lot with just the philosophy of it, the intention of it. Back in the 40s and 50s, when Harry Benjamin first came up with the standards of care for transitioning people, his intention was to help people transition in as happy and healthy a way as possible. And because there weren't that many people weren't out and about and doing this, he had it very tight, very strict guidelines. So, you know, you had to live full time for 2 years in your identified gender. And since most of the people he was working with were male assigned at birth, who identified as female, you basically had men who were having to cross-dress and present as female for a couple of years before they could do anything, at least a year before even going on hormones. And people had different ideas. Again, were very rigid. They were much more rigid. Wanted these people to identify as heterosexual. So unfortunately, I know quite a few trans women from early years, from the 60s, 70s, 80s even, who weren't able to transition because they identified as lesbian. They said, no, I'm attracted to females. I am a female. even though I was assigned male at birth, I'm a female, and I'm attracted to females. And they were denied the option to transition. Therapy is something that's changed over the years, because the idea that somebody would need to be in therapy, like, oh, there's something wrong with you, we need to fix that, you have this mental illness we need to fully address before you can move on, that's fallen by the wayside. And honestly, I get a little braggy, smug about this, but, you know, when I started immersing myself in the trans world back in the 90s, having to be in therapy for a prescribed period of time, a year, was nuts. I'm not going to make somebody come see me every week for a year when they really don't have anything to talk about. You know, they have no issues, they have nothing, they just want transition. And whatever we might need to talk about as far as their transition process, their expectations, that's the big thing, is their expectations after they transition, after they get their hormones, after they get surgery. As long as their expectations are realistic, they know what they need to do to prepare, they're good with themselves, their job, their families, their friends, everything's solid. So what I started doing is I would see people once a month, and then I cut shorter and shorter the period of time. And as I became known to the doctors, the major players in the field, they would trust my judgment. And it became a very individualized process. And then after several years, when the new WPS standards of care came out, they finally said, yes, this needs to be an individualized process between the therapist and the transitioning person. There, we don't have to set a number of sessions or a period of time for anybody to do anything, to live in full-time presentation, to be on hormones before getting surgery, to be in therapy. They started leaving it up to the individual and their providers, mental health and medical providers. So that's been a huge shift. Now, a lot of transitioning people, especially younger people who have had access to the internet, have access to figuring out who they are saying, we know who we are. We don't need anybody. We don't need a therapist giving us permission. So gatekeeper is a word that I got rid of right away. I hate the word gatekeeper. And that's probably the word you were waiting for me to come out with. Therapists used to be known as gatekeepers. Like, we could deny somebody the ability to move on with their transition. And that's a terrible thing. And it started an adversarial process between a client and a therapist, which we certainly don't want. The client would come in trying to say what they thought I wanted to hear, what they think a therapist wants to hear in order to get their letters. And that's terrible. So I right away, you know, I realized, wait, I'm not a gatekeeper. You're telling me this is who you are. Okay, fine. You're telling me what you want. Okay, great. You know what you want. What I want to do is still like Harry Benjamin and everyone else. I want you to get where you want to go in as happy and healthy a way as possible. I want you to be happy, and I want you to be as happy and healthy on the other side of this as you can be. And again, like I said before, I know things that you may not know, because you know things from your experience or from a few of your friends' experiences or from people online that you've happened to, you know, you get into different chats and rooms or, you know, whatever groups. And so you're listening to people who have their own agenda, who have their own way of looking at things, sometimes their own militants around this. But I know things, and I have no agenda except for you to just get where you're going and be happy when you get there. And so I want you to think about things. I want you to be realistic in your expectations. And so having a few sessions with me can be very beneficial to help you do that. And that's what I do. And that's what, so informed consent is you are as fully informed as possible to what the outcome will be when you transition, when you go on hormones, when you get surgery.
What do you find comes up a lot that isn't realistic?
That idea that once I'm on hormones or have had surgery, including facial feminization surgery, then I'm going to be acceptable. It goes back to those messages from childhood that people got, that you're never going to be lovable. You're never going to be acceptable. You're never going to be attractive. You're not, you know, all these messages, you're not going to be good enough. Sometimes I will want to do therapy with people who, I do something called EMDR therapy, eye movement desensitization reprocessing. And that helps people with those early traumas. It helps reprocess those early messages and turn them around so that people aren't being driven by those early messages. And so I really, once in a while, not often, once in a while, I want somebody to go through some EMDR therapy so that they can make decisions here and now as the adult they are. But the idea that I have to look a certain way for people to accept me is a big one for a lot of people, because one of the things that happens is they'll look in the mirror. You know, you get used to looking at seeing yourself in the mirror a certain way. And if you're looking in the mirror and seeing a guy, that's who you see. And you're being critical of that guy because that's not who you want to look like. I mean, all of us are critical enough of ourselves looking in mirrors, but you have a trans woman who keeps seeing a male face, male features, and they're like picking themselves apart and say, no, I just have to change this. I've changed this. I've changed this. And the first thing I tell them, stop looking in the mirror and cover up that mirror and start just going out in the world and interacting with people as you are, as you want to be, as you can wear whatever makeup or hairstyle or anything else. But at the end of the day, we all look the way we look. If I waited until I looked gorgeous to walk out of my door, I'd never leave the house. I'm a cisgender woman. That means my sex assigned at birth matches my identified gender. So I look how I look. This is it. I might put some lipstick on or do my hair or something. Basically, this is how I look. This is my face. Get over it. And when I interact with people, when I put myself out there, when I have my own intention of what am I doing right now? Well, right now I'm talking to you. Right now I might be teaching. Right now I might be counseling. Right now I might be out just jogging. I'm not preoccupied with how I look. If I am, and there's plenty of cisgender people who are, then that's a problem. That's a problem. You're all turned inward, so you're not going to be able to connect. There's connection again. You can't connect with somebody when you're all turned inwards, looking at yourself and preoccupied with yourself. So I'll be talking to people about that and encouraging them to just get out, turn their energy outwards, interact with people as they are. Who are you? Just go with that. And what you project, honestly, is what people will pick up on. A lot. I've seen some people that just, they're very happy and they just project whether they're masculine or feminine, and people pick up on that energy and they're not picked apart. You know, the people out in public will pick up on your insecurities, your anxieties, your demeanor that way. And then that causes them anxiety and that puts them in high alert, and then they start picking you apart. So it's just the way our brains work. Another big thing people don't realize is when you go on hormones, it changes your scent, your smell, and it's unconscious, completely unconscious. But people around you unconsciously will pick up on it. So, for instance, if I have a younger person or sometimes even an older person who's living at home, living with parents, or maybe living with a spouse, and they say, I want to go on hormones. I want to be on hormones until I feel feminine enough to go out. Uh-uh. No. First, if you're living with someone and not telling them, not disclosing, whether it's parents, friends, whoever you're living with, and you're not disclosing, no, I don't recommend that, because they're going to know something's different. When your body starts going through changes, either masculinizing or feminizing, and you're starting to put off a different scent. So even estrogen, you know, you go on estrogen and you start smelling different and your skin starts softening. And there's all these little unconscious cues that something is different. People are going to pick up and it's going to cause problems for you. And then what? What, your parents suddenly kick you out of the house because they say, oh, what are you? You're transitioning, aren't you? And they kick you out of the house. Well, now you're out on the street. Where are you going to go? You're going to couch surf? You know, you're just going, oh yeah, I have friends. No, we need a plan. So whenever I'm working with someone, it's not that I'm not going to say absolutely no, I'm not going to write your letter. It's let's come up with a plan. What's the plan? And if your plan is not realistic, then you don't have realistic expectations, and I'm not going to write your letter until you do. So let's get creative. Couchsurfing, once you get kicked out of your parents' house, is not a realistic expectation. Nobody has that many close friends. Since they're going to get sick of you. So what about your job? Can't go into work on Monday and, you know, dressed in a short skirt and heels. Say, okay, here I am. You have to accept me. That's not a realistic plan. Let's talk to human resources. Let's talk to your boss. Let's see what your workplace policies and procedures are for transitioning. Let's get people on board before you start outward signs of transition so that they feel like they're part of the process and you're not ambushing them and hitting them over the head and say, here I am, you have to accept me. So those are some of the things that I talk about with people.
We're going to take another break. We'll be back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
A for horses, B for mutton, C more cheeks, dig for victory.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better.
Marks and Spencer.
Add Health Triangle Magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
T for two.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We're back from break. Dr. Clark has been giving everyone tips. Let's get back to Dr. Clark. It really is a collaborative effort in a sense because, well, as you said, they're hit with a surprise and then they feel that they've been pitted against maybe and it feels uncomfortable. It feels uncertain to them. I always loved your explanation of the fact that we can look at a person from a distance. And we will know something about them because our eyes tend to shift if we're uncertain of who is in front of us, who's coming towards us, what their gender might be. And let's say it's an evening and it's an alley and you're a female and you're not sure if it's a male approaching you or a female approaching you. You automatically, it's just innate. You will do the checking. You will look to validate the female body parts, the male body parts, not because you're a creep, but because it's about your sense of safety. But then it can also go beyond that. Can you talk a little bit about the differences between the two?
Sure. So you're talking about the difference between the limbic system and the prefrontal cortex. The limbic system is the survival brain, and survival at its most primitive level means survival of the species. And survival of the species depends on mating. So male, female, that's the way we mate. So our primitive brains need to identify from a distance, as you say, is this a male or a female? Is this somebody who might be a potential mate? Or is this somebody who might be somebody I have to fight? That's just programmed into us at the most basic level. And it's programmed into every animal that differentiates male and female. So since it is programmed into us in that most basic level, we're not cognitively aware of it. Our prefrontal cortex, which is our thinking, reasoning, rational brain, isn't aware that we're doing this until, like I tell you, that's what's happening, and then you know. But for the most part, we move through the world with our brain doing all these automated jobs. We're breathing, our hearts are beating, so we have all these things keep us alive. We're registering what's going on in the world around us that might present a danger. And so not just gender, somebody's gender, but if you hear a noise, you immediately need to ascertain, is that something dangerous or not? And we're doing this constantly, and we're not even aware of it. So yeah, when it comes to gender, what happens in today's world is we're just, if something isn't, gives us any anxiety, like we can't immediately unconsciously identify it, then we're going to put more resources into identifying it. That's going to take attention away from whatever we're doing in that moment. And we're also going to start going on high alert. Is this something that's dangerous? So if I'm in a restaurant and I'm being served by somebody comes up, takes my order, and, you know, cognitively, rationally, I'm not looking to see, is this a male or female? I don't care. It's a server. Somebody's a server. But my unconscious brain is reading, is this a male or female? And male and female are sex. Gender is masculine or feminine, man or woman. We can kind of differentiate there. You know, I'll look at the server and I'll just read, is this person male or female, man or woman? And if I see something that I can't tell, my attention is going to go to that. Again, it's going to be unconscious in the beginning until it really becomes something so noticeable that, like, so all-consuming. And that's going to vary really from person to person. We all have things in our makeup that make us more or less anxious. So, but it's there's going to be a little anxiety. There's going to be a little like, who is this? Who's this person? And now I'm trying to order, but part of my brain is trying to figure out, is this person male or female? And now it's wonderful when you know that people can be anything they want, that they can be. They can look like a male. They can have male characteristics, which is broader shoulders, flat chest, wider nose, wider eye spacing. The forehead is heavier. There's all these, the jaw is going to be more square. Okay, so there's all these things that we're just unconsciously reading with a female, the narrower nose, narrower chin, voice, of course, you know, all these things. So we're going to, when we can't figure it out, we're going to look at these other things. And our eyes are probably immediately going to go to somebody's chest. And then they're, well, sometimes we can or can't tell from that. We're going to look at other things. So some people are going to be able to say, you know what, it doesn't matter. Some people are going to say, oh, this is maybe a trans person, so, or gender nonconforming, gender diverse. So, okay, whatever. I don't care. I just want to place my order. And some people are going to get really uptight. You know, and all this is based on our own genetics, our own culture, family, what all these messages that are back in our unconscious brain, we don't even remember or we're aware of. So all it takes is, say, when you're a little kid, you're walking down the street and with your parents and you see somebody who's gender unsure, you can't tell. And your parent says, oh, look at that, and uses some kind of derogatory term, for instance. Okay, you might not actively remember that in adulthood, but now here's somebody that's very similar, and now you have this negative connotation that's been put onto this visual stimuli, and so now you're going to have a negative reaction to this person for no apparent reason. And it's good to know that these things are happening in the brain, because it's not, if somebody is being negative towards a trans person, you know, they may not be aware of it and they may not have any idea why. So you have that. And one of the things that I just throw out there to trans people, they take it or not, they act on it or not, but it's if you're in a situation where you see somebody is anxious around you or hesitant to be connected with you, you know, you could just let them know, you know, I see you're looking at me. I happen to be transgender. I'm a trans female. I'm a trans male. And you give them a big smile. Now you've let them know who you are. So that satisfies that part of their brain. And you attach it to a really positive thing, which is your big smile. And you've been friendly. Now, a lot of, you know, some people are like, hey, that's really cool. I can do that. Some people are like, I don't want to have to do that every time I meet somebody. Okay, don't. And some people are like, hey, it's none of their business, and they get all oppositional. But, you know, we kind of get what we put out there, too. So you can do it on a case-by-case basis. You can do it as you feel like it. Just know that whatever energy you're putting out in the world, you're going to get that back. And at least if you smile, even if you don't go into any explanation at all, just give people a smile. And be aware of your body language and open yourself up so you're giving the message that I am not a threat. That alone can make a world of difference.
You've worked with a lot of couples, one who has transitioned or is in the process of transitioning. Have you seen a lot of positive outcomes, or has it been the opposite?
You know, I've seen a whole gamut, and it just varies from person to person, from couple to couple. So it depends on what was the relationship going into it. If we, do we have say, a cisgender female that's going into relationship with someone she thinks is a heterosexual male. And that's her expectation, that I'm marrying a heterosexual male because I'm a heterosexual female. We're going to go on like that. And then that person, if they transition into the relationship, then that wife is going to feel betrayed, quite often feel betrayed. Not everybody, but that would be typical, feel very betrayed. And then to start questioning herself, well, what does this mean about me? Who am I attracted to? Does this mean I'm a lesbian? And so there's a huge shakeup there, like, you know, and then there's, well, now what does this mean about our relationship moving forward? Because we are visual people. We are tactile people. There is an energy there. There's a male, you know, animus and anima, right? Male, female energy. I found it interesting, just to go off on tangent for a minute. When I was first taking trans people to lunch, I remember I took out this trans woman. She didn't transition to later in life. So she was around 60. And a lot of people might look at her and see a guy in a wig and a dress and makeup. And when I initially saw her, that's what I saw. But I had this sudden awareness. So we're at lunch and we're eating lunch together and we're talking, gabbing away. And suddenly I just had this awareness that, wow, I'm interacting with her as I would with another woman. That she's totally, this is total female energy. And I've become so much more aware of my own responses to people based on gender through this journey of working with trans people and being more aware, just woke about it. But that was so like amazing. I was like, wow, yeah, she's totally a woman and I'm reacting to her as a woman. And so there's that between married, to get married to somebody, it's like, what does that do if they start giving themselves permission to be more something that they've been repressing and now they're letting that go? So now how's that going to go? So for some people, they remain friends. Some people, they are able to have sex. But honestly, some people, they're if they identify as heterosexual, and so you have somebody who's transitioned to either male or female, but they've been in a what looked like a heterosexual relationship, but was really same sex. Now they're like, so we have a trans woman, a heterosexual woman, but that means she wants to have sex with men. And, you know, a lot of times people may decide they're bisexual. It can go either way. But, you know, she wants to have sex with men and she wants to get that because she's missed all that. Now she can open up to it. And, you know, where does that leave the wife? Now we have other people who maybe they know going into it. You know, I've known people that like, this is who I am. This is what I'm going to do. And I'm in the process. And then the person getting involved with them might say, okay, yeah, I can deal with that. And maybe they can, and then maybe they can't. You know, so you have that. You have people who are post-transition, they're living fully in their identified gender. They've done their hormones, their surgeries, whatever. And then whoever they're getting in a relationship with, so, well, that's who they are. And that's who the other person is at that time. So you have that. So it can be all different things. It's very individualized.
Are you seeing anyone who's detransitioning?
I've had a couple of people come to me. Fortunately, no one who I've ever written a letter for has come back and said, oh, I've made a mistake. It's not to say it might not happen, but it hasn't happened. And I think it hasn't happened because I've done my due diligence. You know, I've gone over the expectations, made sure the expectations are realistic. But the other thing is, we are seeing the detransitioners, retransitioners, whatever people want to call them, amongst younger people. And I don't predominantly work with teens, and I try to be really careful when I do. That's where we're seeing young teens that are saying, because of the internet, because they're given these options. And teenagers are at that developmental stage of life where they're discovering their identity and trying on different identities. And it's one thing when you're a teenager and you're trying out being goth and you're trying out being nerdy. You're trying out being a marine biologist and then you decide, no, I want to be an artist, be a nurse. No. So people try out all these identities, but we want to try out a different gender. Okay, do what you want with your hair. Do what you want with makeup, with dress. But when it comes to surgeries and hormones, we have to be really careful. Now, I've worked with a lot of adults who have said, wow, if I could have started this when I was a teenager, how wonderful my life would be. Okay, so I'm not discounting that. I'm saying we have to be really careful and look at who is this person and really know what we're doing before we sign off, like we being therapists and even doctors, sign off on an adolescent saying they want to be the other gender. They want to actually go on hormones or even have surgeries. And because I've had a couple of young people who are now one was 19, another was 21, come to see me who had actually gone on hormones, have irreversible consequences from that because they were assigned female at birth and they went on masculinizing hormones. And that's very different than going on feminizing hormones. You know, knowing about the effects of these hormones and which way you're going to go. Going on masculinizing hormones is something that your voice is going to deepen. You're going to get facial hair. Your body is going to start changing and be more masculine in ways that you can't change back. So to have 19, 20, 21-year-olds who's saying, oh, I made a mistake, is something we don't want to see. No. You know, and conversely, you have somebody who's assigned male at birth, and I've seen them, you know, having panic attacks at the idea that they're going to get an Adam's apple, that they're going to masculinize in ways that are going to be very difficult to reverse. We have to take it case by case. We have to look at what can we do safely, responsibly. Who is this person in front of us? Where are they coming from? What's the whole context of their transition? And one of the things that scares me is trans people who are very militant and are saying, no, young people need, they know who they are. And this is they're politicizing this in a way that they're accusing conservatives of doing. And conservatives are, there's a lot of conservatives, and I hate lumping people onto one thing, but you have people like our governor here in Florida and other governors in Texas. And then all the people that they politicize this and give out misinformation and rile people up, get their limbic systems fear activated so that they're not able to make rational decisions and make it an us and them. And I get that there's people that want to fight back against that. I do. But I don't want to do it by saying, no, let's go completely the other way and make decisions and say, no, every trans person at any age has the right to do whatever they want because kids are kids. Their prefrontal cortex is not fully developed. And so it's just like anything else, you know, when we get, and here again, I'll just throw in another little tangent thing. But one of the things that makes me crazy is when we say that a 14-year-old cannot consent to sexual intercourse, but we turn around and when that same 14-year-old kills somebody, we're going to treat them as an adult and say, oh, we're going to go after you as an adult. No, you can't have it both ways. Either they can't think as an adult or they can, but at least be consistent. And the reality, the science is that their prefrontal cortex isn't fully developed. So if they're making a decision to kill somebody, it's not going to be a rational decision. If they're making a decision to transition, it's can they think it through all the way? But we're also talking about identity. It's complicated. And it's bad enough when we have people, governors, trying to politicize it and conservative people who try to use it for their own agenda. But when we have trans people do this, it makes me nuts because they cause harm. And that I cannot sit by for. You cause harm when you cause someone to suffer and push them maybe to do something, or you reject them because now they've done something you don't like and you think it hurts your cause. Oh no. Oh no. I'm going to speak out. And I have spoken out and I have been attacked. So, but I'll keep speaking out.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Do you mind when you mentioned you've been attacked?
Well, so as an educator, when I saw that, okay, this is happening, there's this detransition is a thing. People are talking about it. It was on, I don't know, 2020 or 60 Minutes or something. So it's really getting some talk. And then I see it in the news. I see it in different areas because this is my field. So I said to my group, we need to be in the forefront of this, of educating people. Again, I want to help people not ever regret transitioning. I want to help them be happy and healthy on the other side of that. So we need to, detransition was the word that was being used, the term. Okay, I don't get hung up on terms, but we have to have a common form of language. So detransition is a common form of language. We can change that. We can talk about it. We can define it. We can do a lot of things. But okay, we put together a workshop on detransition. The intention of that workshop is to let people know what it is, what's actually happening, and help therapists prevent it from happening, to be more mindful, to be more aware, to be more woke. And I hate that our governor like is using the word woke as if it's something bad. Woke is a wonderful thing. I'm going to get a t-shirt that I'm proud to be woke. Why wouldn't I be proud to be woke? What's the opposite? To be like dead and asleep in a coma? So I want people to be aware of what's happening. And because a lot of people in the field were concerned. I had endocrinologists, pediatric endocrinologists calling me and saying, this is what I'm seeing and I'm concerned. I have people calling me, everyone's concerned. So, okay, let's get on the front of this. Let's put out, let's do a workshop and get the conversation going and start doing some education. And so what happened is all I did was say, hey, to a group of sex therapists, I said, hey, I'm doing this work. We're doing this workshop. Register for this workshop. That's it. And all these people, led by a really militant trans man who already didn't like me who had come after me in some other venues, came after me, dragged a whole bunch of other people. And I was on the receiving end of so much criticism, judgment, attack, everything except any kind of opening for rational discussion. That was not present. It was just attacking. And then all the other people that could have, that was on a listserv, people who could have spoken out publicly to get the conversation going or to support me or support the idea, were afraid to. And that's, they spoke to me privately and supported me privately, but they said, I don't want to put a target on my back. That is chilling for everyone. It's chilling for Americans who value free speech. It's chilling for people who are professionals who want to be able to have intelligent discourse about things that are happening in our world. It's chilling for therapists who are so closed-minded that they can't be open to hearing from someone as respectable as me, a professional with my credentials and experience, to just shut me down and try to be so derogatory personally and professionally towards me and not even consider this and to shut that all down. That is chilling in a professional association. That is super chilling. And then some other people that were part of this were expelled from boards. I said, if you do this workshop, you can't be on our board for LGBTQ people. And that happened to a couple of other people that I know personally that were part of this. And so when we can't even talk amongst ourselves, that is not helping these poor kids. And it shuts down research because I've heard that a lot of universities are not supporting research. And so my institution will. So the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, if you want to do a dissertation and around this topic, we will support you wholeheartedly. And if we, hopefully nobody's going to attack us physically because, I'm a wuss that way, but we'll stand up. I'll support anybody. I'll speak out. If I can't do that at this time of life, I might as well go crawl under a rock. I'm speaking out now. So, and thank you, Dr. Goldbauer, for supporting me in doing this and for you then, therefore putting your name out there as well.
And I am sorry that you experienced that. That is very unfortunate. So I want to thank you for your openness. I welcome openness on this show. I think we need it. I think we need all perspectives. I think that's very important. And again, I just could spend hours picking your brain. And I know the audience probably has learned more in this podcast than they probably anticipated learning.
I hope so. And I have a YouTube channel, so Dr. Carol Clark with spaces between it, Dr. space Carol space Clark on YouTube, and I talk about all kinds of things. So the addiction stuff, if you go back, if anybody's thinking, wait, what did she say about this? Because I know I talk fast and I push a lot in there. So what was this about? You can get more. If you want more of me, go to the YouTube channel, and some of the videos are really short, some of them are longer. Just get more in depth or just hear it again. And I hope you'll do that. And my book, I'm really happy my book is out on audiobooks now. So Addict America is on audiobook. And the reader is somebody, a friend and professional voice actress who really mirrors my voice as much as anybody could. So that was very, the universe brought me her. That was great. And I just so appreciate this opportunity. Dr. Goldbauer, you've been a blessing in my life. I'm so glad that our lives are mingling and we can get to go on and do all these wonderful things together. And so thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Clark. And the feelings are mutual.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a great day, week, year, and speak up when you can.
Thank you for listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On. I hope you join us again.